From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking spam this hour, the unwanted, unending tide of cheesy marketing come-ons that clogs email boxes across the country. It's not life or death, but it sure is infuriating, and it's on the rise. Spam is a cheap way to reach consumers in a bad economy. It's a third of all email now, and more, much more, is on the way this hour on Point. You've got spam and what to do about it. We begin with a more serious offense, identity theft. Federal prosecutors have charged a computer help desk employee in New York with stealing financial information on more than 30,000 people over the past 3 years. It's the largest case of identity theft ever uncovered. Brooke Masters is a business reporter with The Washington Post. I asked her to describe how the alleged identity scam worked.
Prosecutors allege that he worked for a company called TCI, Teledata Communications, Inc., that basically made computer terminals and software that allowed banks and lending institutions and actually medical centers to check people's credit. He worked on the help desk, was not a particularly important employee, but what he managed to do was get a hold of passwords that all of these lending institutions used to access the big credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. And then later on, after he had stopped working on the help desk, he used those access codes to run random people's credit reports. Basically, people in the Bronx and Brooklyn, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office, would contact Cummings and say, hey, I want to run XYZ name and social security number, and he allegedly ran it.
And what do we know about the victims, as it were? There were a lot of them. Was there any pattern to who was picked up? Is it just who happened to come across Mr. Cummings' computer screen?
As far as we can tell, there were about 20 or 30 people in the New York boroughs who, basically fraudsters, who got a hold of Cummings and discovered he was their source of information, and they went to him with names. So I think if you were unlucky enough to run across one of those people's radar screens, he would run those names.
And what kind of names would they be taking to him? Who did they want information on? How did the information help the scammers?
What the a credit report will have on, as anybody who's ever bought a house knows, is it basically has the numbers of all your bank accounts, the numbers of all your credit cards, information about you that the bank uses to decide whether to lend you money, but that an identity thief can use to, say, order up internet service and charge to you or, buy a BMW.
But we're talking about 30,000 names over 3 years, so this is not one by one, presumably. There's some real scale here.
Absolutely. I mean, what he had done is, allegedly, is set up a laptop where he would, download 600 names at a time. They don't know how many of those 30,000 people actually, were victimized beyond having their reports run. They're still working on it. They only know so far of under $3 million in losses, which is actually tiny because your average identity theft victim, loses something like $17,000.
Right.
Although, in general, it's not charged to them. In general, the credit card companies and the banks eat the money. But there's a significant loss with each time an identity is stolen.
Do we know how this managed to go undetected for so long? Were the people who individually were being scammed aware of it? Were they reporting it to the police? Were the police trying to figure out how this was going on?
As far as we can tell, nobody seems to have noticed the running of the names until late last year, early this year. And in about February of this year, a bunch of consumers complained to Ford Motor Credit that their credit reports had been requested by Ford Motor Credit, and they were not in the market for a car, and they wanted to know why Ford was getting their credit reports.
Mm-hmm.
At which point, working backwards, Ford determined that thousands and thousands of reports had been requested in the name of Ford Motor Credit that were not actually done by the company. They were all out of one Grand Rapids, Michigan branch.
Brooke Masters, we're told, or we read, that this is the largest case of identity fraud ever detected, I guess in the number of names, the quantity of information taken. But what's the sense? Is this going on all over the country, and this is just happens to be one operation that was tripped up, or is this rare?
No, I think it's actually extremely common. The scale is somewhat unusual. But the idea of breaking into a business or having an insider with access to sensitive information and, stealing whole batches of people's IDs is actually the way things are going. I actually just got off the phone with the Federal Trade Commission, and the woman who runs their identity theft program said they now believe, although they don't have hard numbers yet to back it up, that about half of all identity theft cases now come from sort of these bulk thievery rather than, one guy gets your credit card out of your wallet and then walks off with it.
And how many Americans might be affected in a given year?
I don't know, and I don't think law enforcement knows, because many people, you know, get so frustrated in trying to report it that they never make a report to the Federal Trade Commission, which keeps the centralized database. You know, they'll report to their local police, who will say, well, you live in New York, but, you know, after all, the company that it was charged on is in Chicago, so you really ought to report it to Illinois. So you call Illinois, and Illinois says, well, but you live in New York. And there's a lot of trouble, you know, dealing with our new Internet economy.
Is there anything individuals can do, or what's the FTC doing to plug this hole?
Well, there are a couple of things. As an individual, you can ask for copies of your credit report. You can read your bills really carefully. You know, don't just pay your bill without checking out the small charges. You can ask for copies of your credit report. If you have any reason to suspect that you have a problem with your credit report, you should immediately call the credit bureaus and say, I think I have a problem. And under some legislation that was passed last year, you're entitled to a free copy of your credit report if you have reason to believe that there's an unauthorized use of your credit. Then go through it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that there's no bank account in, you know, Podunk, Iowa that has nothing to do with your house in Alabama. If you then find things that are suspicious, you can take them to the police and make a police report, even though it's a pain, and often they really are not particularly helpful. Because once you have that police report in hand, you can go back to the credit bureau and say, see, I'm not just somebody trying to skip out on my debts. Please, you know, I've got a problem. Take this stuff off my record.
And they likely will.
Yes, they generally will, and they'll put a fraud alert on your account, which means that they won't let people run your credit again or add a new form of credit, say a new credit card or a checking account or a loan, without doing a much more formal inquiry. You know, they won't treat it as an average account. They'll say, the account has had problems with fraud before, we've got to watch it.
Brooke Masters, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Brooke Masters is a business reporter with The Washington Post. She spoke with me earlier today from Washington. The promise of the Internet once meant we could shop online, get in touch with our old high school prom date, and find the books that fit our tastes to a T. Now all that's true, but what most of us use the web for is email. And most of our email, an awful lot of it, is spam. Mountains of unwanted email hawking hair removal, Viagra, and free vacations. It's raising blood pressure, clogging corporate networks, and sullying the utopian notion, or maybe just a civil notion, of what the web might be. But can we do anything about it? Does the First Amendment mean spam in your inbox, like it or not? What's your level of spam rage? How do you deal with it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now by Ray Everett Church, co-founder of Coalition Against Commercial Email and co-author of Internet Privacy for Dummies. Good evening and welcome, Ray Everett Church.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. I'm also joined from New York City tonight by On Point News analyst Amity Schlaes, senior columnist for the Financial Times. Hello, Amity. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom.
Okay, Ray Everett Church, take us into spam. We all see it pile up in our inbox like crazy every day. Every time you come back to the computer, there's more of it. What's the volume of spam? How does it compare with what there used to be? What's the trend?
Well, the volume of spam has been traditionally very difficult to understand and to quantify, in part because email is decentralized. The Internet is decentralized. Mm-hmm. But as best we can tell, various research organizations have looked at volumes and talked to Internet service providers. And the estimate right now is that the problem parses out to about 700 to 800 pieces of spam per user per year. And that has increased fairly dramatically back when spam first started to be a problem in about 1994, 95, with just a few messages per user per year. Now Jupiter Research says that number is up to 700 or more.
And the trend line, we're told it's going to get even greater. Why?
Because in part the economics of email encourage more spam. Spam is unlike postal mail, unlike telemarketing and other forms of commercial advertisement, where the bulk of the costs are borne by the advertiser. You know, someone has to print a piece of mail and put a stamp on it and send it to you. But email, once it leaves the sender's system, the costs are most predominantly borne by the intermediaries, the people delivering the mail, and the ultimate receiving service provider.
So it's irresistibly cheap for people who want to get some kind of marketing message out.
It is indeed. And the cost of entry into the market of becoming a spammer is extremely low. And there's very little incremental additional cost for the next, 10 million emails that you send.
Ray Everett Church, you're in the business of watching this closely. How do you define spam? Is it anything that doesn't come from my friends and family or something more precise than that?
Well, as you mentioned at the top of the hour here, I was I'm part of the Coalition Against Unsolicited Commercial Email, and we define spam as unsolicited commercial email.
Okay.
Simply enough, this means commercial solicitations that come from organizations that you haven't given permission to send you mail, or with whom you don't have an existing business relationship, and certainly mail. From friends, forwards, junk, sort of chain letters and the like,
right.
May be annoying, but they aren't the greatest problem. The greatest problem is really companies who are trying to sell you some sort of quack medical remedy, some sort of get-rich-quick scheme, or even sometimes legitimate products, but are using techniques that mass mail out to large numbers of people with whom the sender has no relationship.
And what's the structure of this business? Who's doing all this spamming? Where does it come from? It just shows up in the inbox and there are piles and piles of it. But what's the origin?
Well, folks have done a bit of research into this, and there's a website called spamhaus.org, S-P-A-M-H-A-U-S.org, and they've done a lot of research into this. And according to them, most spam, about 90% of the spam that hits U.S. and European email boxes, is attributable to about 20 or 30 individuals or organizations.
You're kidding me.
So it's a fairly small group that's doing the vast amount of the spam. And if you look at the technology that these folks use, there have been a number of interviews recently with spammers and spamming organizations who are very proud in the fact that they send out 2, 3, 5 billion messages a month. And they do it at fairly low cost, and pass that savings on to whoever is trying to peddle their herbal Viagra this week.
We're going to dive way into spam this hour, but Amity Schles, jump in here and give us your psychological analysis, if you would. Why do we get so upset about spam? More upset, perhaps, than we get about junk mail.
Oh, it's because of our special feelings about a new medium. We always have a special feeling about a new medium. It's like a new love. We don't like to see it degraded and dragged into the public and abused. We used to have a sign hanging in the newsroom where I worked regarding an old medium, print journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, writing is like sex. First you do it for love, then you do it for a few good friends. And then you do it for money.
Oh, so this is the sad tale of the Internet's decline?
The same is true for email, which has gone from being this special messenger to our special friends to being the harlot of our lives, the harlot of the Internet. That's email now.
So we're howling here about paradise lost? Is that your view, Amity?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I remember when I first started having email, I gave my email address to economists only because I like to hear from economists.
But everybody else forget about it.
And that was our secret society, and of course that is those are the historical roots of the Internet. It was a bunch of nerds talking to each other, and they enjoyed their exclusive company and the feeling they were in a club more.
Ray Everett Church, what about it? Amity Schles suggests to a certain extent that this is just a kind of a loss of innocence, that of course that we live in a commercial culture, and of course there will be commercial communication. Do we just need to get over it, or is this really something offensive and an imposition?
Well, there is an element of it that is, sort of paradise lost. But increasingly, as more and more people use the Internet for their communications, for their business, for their education and research, and just for socializing with friends and family and online friends, those interactions are tainted by spam. And their activities online suddenly take on a different tinge when you're afraid that you're going to get bombarded by pornographic solicitations and get-rich-quick scams.
Ray Everett Church, stand by. We're going to take a look at how spam may even be changing the way we use the Internet. Listeners, you can join our conversation. What's your level of spam fury, of spam rage? Does spam clog your email box? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about spam, what many see as the curse of the email world and the battle to shut it down. We've been talking with Ray Everett Church, co-founder of the Coalition Against Unsolicited Commercial Email. You can join us as well. Is spam free speech? Is it an outrage? Is it both? And did you think your little email world would be sacrosanct as spam despoiled your online utopia? Has fear of spam changed your online habits? Do you tread more carefully now on the web? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to welcome into our conversation Laura Betterly. She's a direct mail marketer and president of Data Resource Consulting, joining us from, is it Dunedin, Florida, Laura?
It's actually Dunedin.
Dunedin. Okay, Dunedin, Florida. Laura Betterly, we've given you the kind of formal introduction here, but you were recently on page one of the Wall Street Journal, in quotes, as the spam queen. I don't know if you're still standing by that title, but you send out an awful lot of mail from your relatively small operation in Florida. How's it work? How much do you send out, and why do you do it?
Well, first of all, I want to clarify something that the spam queen quote was an out-of-context quote, because I spent 2 days with this very nice girl who was the reporter from the Wall Street Journal, and she we talked about many different definitions, and we don't send things that are unsolicited. We want people's permission. We don't want – I mean, if you're not going to like – what we send you, what's the point? It's bad marketing. You know what I'm saying?
So, maybe we do. I mean, the quote out of context is, "You can call me spam queen. I don't really care as long as I'm not breaking any laws. You don't have to love me or like what I do for a living."
You know, like I said, let me finish what I was saying.
Absolutely.
Which was basically, she had said, well, some people say the definition of spam is any commercial email. And I said, well, if that's the case, then you can call me the spam queen.
Right.
And so it was out of context, and it went around the world. But the fact of the matter is, even with all the people who have been forwarding me all their unsolicited email, I've looked at it all, actually, and I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of messages, and only one of them really came from me, interestingly enough.
Laura Betterly, we saw in the Wall Street Journal today a lot of angry response to the interview and the story that was in, I guess, last week. We'll let you put the spam queen name tag down for a moment, but we'd really appreciate your insight on how the business works, on why you got into it, on what scale of emails you send out, and what kind of return is there? Is it a good business?
It is a good business model, but the reason why I got into this, I mean, I'm actually a founder of a dual MP3 player, a company called VisioSonic, known as PCDJ.
Okay.
Toured the world with that. Have been, our equipment's been used in Ministry of Sound and, all over the world with a lot of big DJs. And I like the internet world. Started that company in 99, and it's still in existence, and it's a wonderful thing. I mean, I've been very involved in, the whole MP3 thing.
But now, as we understand, you and a staff of three or four send out millions and millions of emails. It's possible, I suppose, that any person online within the sound of my voice may have received one from you. How's it work? Who are your clients? What's the payback?
It depends. Every offer is different. But for the most part, we work with different things that not everybody else has. First of all, we don't do anything X-rated. We do not do anything drug-related. We do not do anything Viagra-related because, A, that's saturated, and B, it's bad marketing. I mean, for me as a woman to get something about Viagra in the mail is kind of stupid. I mean, I don't need it. I don't want it. It's just a waste of time. But what we have been working with is a lot of software offers. I'm working with a lot of entrepreneurs who don't know how to market and have good ideas and want to see if there's a market for their things. We have very targeted lists that we have asked their permission, and we have legitimate, when you hit reply, it goes to someone. When you hit unsubscribe, it gets unsubscribed.
What's a typical size of a mailing you might do, Laura Betterly?
Usually if we do a test, we'll do for 10 or 20,000 in a target list. If we get a decent response rate, and again, some of those response rates you saw in that article, I said you can make money with blah, but that's not what we're going for. We're actually going for a higher response rate. And actually, looking at marketing from a marketing perspective, as opposed to let's throw so much against the wall and some of it'll stick.
But it did get our attention. I think you were saying you could make money, you could get by on as little as a 0.0001 return. Maybe you'd send out, what is that, a million emails and have 100 takers.
That's true, and you could do it that way, and you could make money that way. I mean, it was my impression that the actual article was going to show that there are responsible, legitimate online marketers, and that it is a viable business model if done responsibly. You know, I take offense at you know, some of the stuff that goes out there and that gets that people do mail, and there are unsavory characters out there who, you know, harvest email lists. I've saw a business opportunity for $150. You'll get like 13 million harvested email names.
What is a harvested email name, Laura?
Meaning, you take a bot and you go out on the net and you pull any email address you can get that, you know, when you're going out and you're searching. This is not coming from any particular source. They don't have the time and the date that someone opted in. They don't have the original source for this particular list. This is just...
It's just scooping up email addresses.
Exactly. And then what they'll do is then they'll also give you a software package will rip your headers so that they can't go ahead and find who you are. So you're basically, they're selling an opportunity so that you can hide and be underneath the radar and whatnot. And that doesn't work.
Laura Bitterly, what do you think of the rage that is expressed day after day all over the country against spam? Does it make you feel bad? Do you think it's misplaced? Is spamming or mass emailing your constitutional right?
Well, I think that everybody should have an opportunity to make money whatever way that that's legitimate and not intrusive, and that they, like I said, we get permission. So I don't feel what we do is, you know, and I don't really have a proper, I mean, some people worked it with different definitions of spam. I don't think it should be sent out unsolicited. There should be a permission in there. I'm also a member of a group called DoNotEmailList.org. And that is, we've been calling for a national do not email list, just like in direct marketing, you have a do not call list.
Mm.
You know, I am very surprised on how emotional people are getting over the whole email issue, though. I mean, I can get emotional over terrorism. I can get emotional over teenage pregnancy, drug abuse, but we're talking about an email, you know. So I'm actually kind of shocked the amount of emotional response. But
and yet we know there's a lot out there. Laura Bitterly, stand by. Ray Everett Church, I want to get your response to how Laura Bitterly is putting her business forward. Is this just a good, upright American direct marketer in a new medium, period?
Well, I can't really comment as to Ms. Betterly's business practices and how she obtains permission. There's a lot of details in the type of privacy policy you have when you gather people's addresses and what expectations those people have when they give you an email address in terms of what they're expecting to receive and who that address might be given to or traded with down the road. I'm not familiar enough with Ms. Betterly's practices to comment on that, but certainly that the details are really what make spam and a legitimate commercial email different. It's all about permission. It's all about the expectations of the customers, the consumers, and the nature of the permission given when you give somebody your email.
Ray Everett Church, describe the range of ways in which people get this quote unquote permission. My impression is that often it's a little tiny checked box that you might not even see or fine print in an agreement when you buy something that says you can share my email address. How do people scoop up permissions? And more broadly, what's the range of ways in which people get email addresses? How do I end up on these lists?
Well, some sites gather email addresses where, you know, there may be a blank on the homepage that says, if you'd like our email newsletter, put your email address in here.
But they can't get it just by me visiting the site.
Typically, no. There are a few odd instances in which that occurs, but they're pretty rare. You in most cases have given them your email address through the context of some sort of business transaction or some sort of request, and that's we're talking about legitimate email marketers there.
Well, now, is it really legitimate? I mean, couldn't I give my web address to get some service in return? The next thing I know, it's been sold and resold and resold, and now it's everywhere.
Well, that's in fact the case. It all depends on what disclosures they make, if any, at the time you give that email address up. We encourage consumers to look carefully for a privacy policy, understand what use will be made of your personal information before you give it up. Because once you give it up, who knows what will be done with it. If they make a statement, a clear statement in a privacy policy, the law can hold them to that. Mm-hmm. And if they violate that promise, they can be held accountable.
Amity Schles, I don't know about you, but as I go around the web, and I guess I surf a little less than I used to, maybe this is part of the reason why, I don't feel like I have time to read all the reams of fine print that may define what I'm getting into every time I click on something.
Well, I'm not sure you necessarily need to, but it's there. It raises a question of whether you want to have government regulate this and be in charge of whether regulating spam, or whether you want to go the line of developing better software to block spam. That's
the divide in the road.
That's the divide in the road. And we don't read all the boilerplate in the contract when we buy a house, yet we can be assured, because we have legal certainty, because we live in a rule of law culture, that probably most of that boilerplate is okay and we agree with it.
Yep.
We should read it, but we don't. Sort of like that.
But on the web, I don't feel quite that same level of confidence in the fine print.
No, not right. Well, not in a contract with a strange person, no. It's the Wild West. It's the Wild West. Every Marshall McLuhan is the prophet here. The medium is the message, and every medium has a different message. And maybe the job of the email medium has been to do social communion, to create new communities, because the rage we tend to feel at interruption is sort of like if someone would make a commercial in the middle of a church service. That's the feeling.
So it's a communion of rage you're talking about, around.
We
expected.
We had a feeling that we were doing some kind of society work. We were having some kind of social session going on with our email, with our chat discussions, and then comes this interloper. And I think it's interesting that we created this new social space for ourselves within AOL, outside AOL, where we chatted about stuff. And that's what the message of this particular medium turned out to be.
But the purity that people wanted or expected or thought they deserved or had a right to there just isn't there. Listeners, you can join us. We're talking about spam. Is it a curse or something else for you? Heather's on the line. Welcome, Heather. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
So I have this problem with porn solicitations.
Pornographic solicitation via spam?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've got a Hotmail account, which I use to check my personal email at work.
Right.
And I can't do it anymore because I don't know how I got on this list, but every day I get, you know, some kind of very interesting picture that I don't want my boss to see if he happens to walk past my desk.
Can you just block it somehow, Heather? Can you filter it out? Is that part of what Hotmail offers?
Well, that's part of the problem. Hotmail does have a spam blocker, but they basically send it from a different address every day. So I think what they're doing is basically opening a Hotmail account, sending out a whole bunch of these things, closing that account, opening another one, and sending them out again. So you can't block it because every day it's a different address.
So what's the solution you'd like to see, government control or better software?
I don't know. I don't know if the software could actually do anything because, you know, you'd have to block every address that you don't know personally. So I guess government control would be best because, you know, this kind of thing is kind of embarrassing if the wrong person happens to see you reading your email.
Yeah, and there suddenly is a lot of flesh. We've probably all had that experience, and it makes it, depending on your appetites, it can make it pretty uncomfortable. Heather, thanks for your call. Ray Everett Church, what about the capacity of software to deal with the ingenuity of spammers?
Well, software is a help in the process. Software is not the entire answer. I think if technology could solve the spam problem completely, it probably would have by now. But you know, email is a very pliable technology. The internet itself was invented in part to help deliver data to and fro when connections were interrupted. So, I mean, the technology is very pliable, and spammers take advantage of that. But Heather raises a very interesting point there, technology isn't working for her, and technology, I think, is an important part of the process of solving this issue. But there are also other concerns, other ways of approaching it. And I certainly have a concern when it comes to talking about government control.
Aren't there at least a couple of dozen states that now have some kinds of laws governing email, unsolicited commercial email?
There are about 25 states that have one form of law or another. In most cases, these are laws that set basic standards for being truthful in your email sending, not using fake return addresses, deceptive subject lines to try and trick people into opening mail, and the like. There's nothing wrong with setting standards that say don't be fraudulent and deceptive. But
what about a standard that says don't send unsolicited commercial email?
Well, that's a bit more complicated, and we feel that at the Coalition Against Unsolicited Commercial Email, the control is best in the hands of those who are harmed by the spam, namely consumers and service providers. And there's an effective model in the law already, law dealing with excesses of telemarketers and junk faxes. Junk faxes have been completely outlawed since the early 1990s. And occasionally they still occur, but it's not near the problem that it was in the early 90s, and that's because the law gives those who receive junk faxes the ability to take the senders of junk faxes to court to sue them for $500 per fax. And really what you wind up with is an economic incentive on the part of those who are harmed and a disincentive to those who are causing the harm in the first place.
So are you calling for that in the email arena as well, that I could take a spammer to court?
The Coalition Against Unsolicited Commercial Email has worked very hard for many years advocating for exactly that, a law based upon the existing law dealing with telemarketing legal issues and junk faxes that gives recipients and their service providers the ability to go after spammers who do them harm.
Laura Betterly, could you live under that kind of government regulation? Could your business survive?
Well, we deal with opt-in lists, and like I said, we get our guys permission. Anyone who doesn't want to be a part of it, you know, absolutely lets us know and unsubscribes. But before we mail any solicitation whatsoever, we inform an individual that we got their name and from whom, and that is, you know, if they have a problem with it, to please let us know. But there's another problem that exists for us as legitimate mailers that I don't think has ever really been brought up, which is that if somebody goes ahead and complains to, let's say, a spam cop and whatnot, mm-hmm. we as legitimate online marketers will actually get we will be told that there's a complaint, but we never get to know who. So we can't say, hey, this is where this guy came from, and this is exactly where he opted in. This is the time, the date, the IP address, and so forth. So,
but maybe that shows the weakness of opting in, because that guy doesn't want in anymore. Laura Betterly, there's a lot to talk about tonight, but I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us. Laura Betterly is president of Data Resource Consultant in Dunedin, Florida. We're talking about spam, the curse of the email world. What tricks do you use to avoid spam to keep your email spam-free? And is spam any different than direct mail? Have you learned to love your spam? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about spam, about the curse of the email world and the battle to shut it down. Has fear of spam changed your online habits, your use of email? Should spam be illegal? Is it worse somehow than telemarketing, than junk mail? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Ray Everett Church. He's co-founder of the Coalition Against Unsolicited Commercial Email. And with our news analyst, Amity Schles, we're joined now by Carl Jacob. He's CEO of Cloudmark, a manufacturer of anti-spam software, joining us from San Francisco. Good evening and welcome, Carl Jacob.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. You make software that deals with spam. How does it do it? How effective is it?
Well, the great thing about CloudMark's product, SpamNet, is it actually leverages a lot of this outrage that people are feeling to fight the problem itself.
So how does that work?
Well, when you get a spam message, you click a block button, and it blocks it for everybody else who's connected into the network. So it basically allows anybody who downloads this add-in into Outlook to hit the block button and block the spam for everyone else.
So it's like, It's like sharing music files here, in a sense. I mean, if one person who's got your software blocks something, it's blocked for everyone else who has the software.
That's correct. And it's like sharing music. It's much more, in this case, sharing your opinion about what is spam, and allows, you know, people who are upset about this and who don't like to get spam to basically vote and say, hey, I think this is spam, and save their friends, family, and other people on the Internet from that same outrage.
What if I get email from an old friend that I don't like anymore, let's say, and I click the no more button? Does that mean he can't email anybody in the universe ever again?
Well, we thought about that. We actually have a trust system built into it, so that basically you have to become a trusted user by blocking spam that other people agree with over time. And if someone blocks a message that other people think isn't spam, they can click unblock, and it actually votes the other direction.
Wow, so this is pretty radical. How does this compare, Carl Jacob, with the software that's been out there, or how most software works now in attacking spam?
Well, it's completely different. All the other software packages that are out there basically look for words inside of the message, trying to figure out what the message is trying to say, trying to look for things like Viagra or a hair loss solution. And the problem with that, of course, is that words and text messages and the kinds of marketing messages spammers are using can change, and even the products they're selling, as Laura was saying, can change over time. So the key is really to leverage the people's opinion and kind of all these people out there who don't want to get spam anymore to give us the information we need to block the spam rather than looking for particular words in the message.
Ray Everett Church, how about it? Is this too radical for your tastes to put all the people to work in blocking the spam? If anybody thinks it's spam, at least for the moment?
Not at all. Not too radical at all for me. In fact, I'm actually a user of CloudMark's SpamNet software. Carl actually invited me to give it a try just before it launched, and I've tried a lot of anti-spam technology solutions over the years, and it's actually the only one that after I tested it, I left on my computer. It seems to work very well for me. It gets upwards of 80% of the spam, and some days it gets 100% of the spam, catches it, sweeps it out of my mailbox, and I get very, very few false positives. That is, you know, letters from grandma or great aunt blocked out.
So, Carl Jacob, it sounds like you've got a real people's revolt here. Do you think that this could eventually change the economics of spam so that it just wasn't worth the trouble anymore?
Well, we think it will change the economics of spam, but I think spammers like telemarketers and direct marketers will adapt. And honestly, I think they'll reform their ways. I think, you know, earlier we were talking about Laura and the way she was sending mail messages in the appropriate way only to people who'd opted in. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to force people who've been spamming and just sending mail messages out to a whole list of people and harvesting these email addresses to only send messages to people who've either A, opted in or expressed an interest in those messages, which will change the economics, but I think in the end it'll be a benefit for everyone, and maybe we'll have that nice safe haven you all were talking about earlier.
Carl Jacob, thanks for joining us tonight. Carl Jacob is CEO of CloudMark. It's a manufacturer of anti-spam software. He joined us from San Francisco. Lisa's on the line. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi.
I've
been interested in hearing what people have said, and I've had very similar experiences, especially the woman who was talking about getting the pornographic emails.
It can really rain down.
Oh, yeah. I mean, amazing things, I'm just surprised, are you know, flying around.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, I think that, you know, part of the problem is that people have been trying to use email for more than it's actually good for.
What do you mean by that, Lisa?
I think what people are trying to do is, you know, is not just send transactional information, but I think people are trying to do more collaboration online, and that's...
Isn't that part of the vision, the dream? Isn't that what the web was supposed to make possible?
Absolutely, but I think email, unfortunately, is really just woefully inefficient for doing that, and I think a lot of the kinds of tools that you're talking about tonight, the anti-spam tools, are just mm-hmm. Band-Aids that aren't really effectively going to solve the problem. But I think there's other kinds of software that are being developed now that are much better for that vision of collaboration.
Well, a lot of people are working on that, but you raise this issue again. I want to thank you for calling, Lisa. Ray Everett Church, can you imagine? Lisa's suggesting that what this is exposing is the weaknesses in email itself, that we've expected too much of it. Are people actually turning away from email? Is it a less attractive communications vehicle now that we have this spam problem nosing in all the time?
Well, I definitely think, having talked with a lot of technologists, the current email system is the worst system developed, except for all the others, to steal a phrase. But this is the problems related to spam have in fact changed the way people are using both email and the web. Increasingly, people are giving false information when they're asked for it online.
Mm-hmm.
They're complaining in sort of almost a knee-jerk reaction when they receive legitimate email that they may have asked permission or may have given permission to be sent.
Mm-hmm.
It all kind of looks the same, and people are quick to hit that reply button and complain button and the block button and the like. And in some cases, new users to the internet are being scared when they first open up their very first email account, already there's barnyard animal sex staring back
right
at them the first time they
Boom.
Open the email box.
I know it's made me a much less generous email user. I don't want to share that email with anybody. I don't absolutely have to.
Absolutely. And so people are a bit more reticent. Email is still kind of a complex and complicated thing for some folks, and they get online, they fight with their email, they finally get it, and it's all sorts of garbage. They get discouraged and get suspicious about doing business online and relying on this new technology. And that's bad for the entire system. That's bad when people distrust the system.
Now, Ray, let's get one more call here.
Sure.
Dan's calling from Chicago. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Wow. Barnyard animal sex. At least someone said it. These email titles are awful.
Yes, they are.
A couple of comments, and then I have two questions. I'll take my answer offline. Number one, I think email is a tremendously powerful tool. It's brought a lot of people closer together.
Sure.
I mean, business transactions, obviously, a lot more seamless. And I'm about 99% sold on the fact that I think email legitimately is free speech. I mean, just because it's a different medium shouldn't negate the fact that it is, in fact, a company or a person expressing themselves.
Duly noted. Dan, our time's running down. Take us to your question.
Okay. Number one, I can't believe that 20 or 30 companies represent about 90% of the spam that's out there.
That's mind-blowing.
One is, are those companies profitable? Number two, in the litigious society we live in, when does this become harassment and someone take up a lawsuit?
Dan, we got it. Our time's going. Let me take it to Ray. Ray, how about it? Is it really 20 or 30 companies doing all this spamming? And could we have harassment suits against spammers?
It is indeed. The research indicates that it is a fairly small number, relatively small number of companies responsible for the largest volume there. And for them, it appears to be quite profitable. Of course, as I said earlier, the cost of getting into the spam business is fairly low. You know, the going rate right now for email addresses on CD-ROM is about $5 or $6 per million.
And a harassment charge, could it stick?
A harassment charge could stick. In fact, some service providers have told spammers to stop, and when they haven't, they've brought suit against them. Harassment versus trespass is a sort of a legal question.
Sounds like a legal ticket.
Ray
Everett Church, we're running out of time right there, and I'm sorry for it, but I want to thank you for joining us this hour. It's been great having you.
My pleasure, Tom.
Ray Everett Church is co-founder of the Coalition Against Unsolicited Commercial Email. Amity Schley's a historical precedent.
Oh, yes. Well, in Paris, they had PNEU, the PNEU, P-N-E-U, the pneumatic letter. You send it through a tube in 153 miles of tubes under Paris to your love or to your taxpayer if you were the government.
And it was romantic until it wasn't.
Romantic, wonderful, different medium, lived and died.
We hope.
A reminder that email, too, may be a passing phenomenon.
Well, we'll see. Amity, thanks so much for joining us. It's been great having you. Okay, thanks for the PNEU. Listeners, you can join this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, trying to save an Olympic tradition, this is On Point. This Friday, the International Olympic Committee will vote on whether or not to eliminate the pentathlon from the Olympic Games. If it gets the boot, the pentathlon will be the first sport dropped from the Olympics since polo was nixed in the 1930s. To the spectators on the sidelines, the pentathlon looks like a bizarre hodgepodge of running, pistol shooting, swimming, horseback riding, and fencing. But to the sports aficionados, the pentathlon tests the range of skills that define a true athlete. Robert Marbot is the executive director of Pentathlon USA and a leader in the effort to preserve the pentathlon in the Olympics. In this radio diary, he says if the pentathlon is dropped, the Olympics will lose their soul.
Without knowing the history of pentathlon, you would sit here and look at the five sports and go, how in the world did anybody put these five sports together? And the ancient pentathlon dealt with the courier, the elite courier service of the military back 2,700 years ago of delivering a message. Now, when Pierre Coubertin, who was the founder of the Olympics, redeveloped the modern Olympics and created, he's actually our creator of our sport, he created a made-for-Olympics sport, rejuvenating and reviving the idea of a military courier. And so your transportation sports are running, swimming, horseback jumping. And your defense mechanisms were pistol shooting and fencing or sword fighting. Ultimately, pentathlon's the soul of the Olympics. There's only two or three sports that are left in the modern Olympics that can trace their heritage back 2,700 years. We're also the only sport created by the founder of the Olympics. And still today, it is the ultimate test of an athlete. Running and swimming for your endurance, pistol shooting and fencing in terms of your test of control, in terms of mechanisms, another inanimate object. And then finally, the horseback jumping in dealing with another animal. And it truly tests athletic prowess in the truest sense across all mechanisms, all another use of another animal, yourself, as well as you against another competitor in fencing. And no other sports provide such a true test of athletic prowess. I'm very concerned that the Olympics may move into everything's based off of television purely. It would be like having governance based off of polling at every turn. And if we get in a situation where TV ratings equals, in the political world, polling ratings, that concerns me a lot because that means you cut out the soul of the Olympics in the truest sense. You cut out the tradition, the history, and the spirit that was founded with Coubertin. And if we start cutting out and start messing with that, it may end up leading to what happened to the ancient games, where after it was successful for a period of time, people started messing around with the traditions and the histories, and then the Olympics died and faded away. And I hope we don't move down a path that starts making history and tradition irrelevant toward the Olympicism and Olympic sport. I've been around the sport three quarters of my life, and I hope my children will be able to compete in the sport. If we die on the program, if we get killed by the IOC this coming Friday, we would go away as a sport. We were made for the Olympics by Coubertin. So without the Olympics, we would not exist. We simply would die as a sport. And where you, as Prince Albert would say, you'd see modern pentathlon at the Olympic Museum and you'd never see it competed again.
Robert Marbot is a former pentathlete and executive director of Pentathlon USA. The IOC will vote on the pentathlon's fate as well as the fate of Olympic baseball and softball at a meeting this Friday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by